It's time for Cofield and Company in the Findlay Toyota Studio on ESPN Las Vegas.
Hang all the mistletoe, I'm gonna get to know you better. This Christmas, and as we trim the tree.
Cofield and Company here on a Tuesday on the road on this Tuesday as we are in sunny Dallas, at least the Metroplex area. We're actually in Frisco, Texas on this Tuesday, Jerry World North, as we're hanging out at the Ford Center, nice giant foyer, as we'd call it, here outside the football field, as we'll be in the stadium in just a little bit. Small stadium, 12,000 capacity, 11,000 capacity, expected to have 7,000, 8,000 here, so it should be a rowdy atmosphere, should be loud, should be a fast track, and Matt Neverett's going to be on the call of the game, and Matt always joins us before games on Fridays, but we got a Tuesday game here for UNLV football, and let's talk about a few things. First of all, the fact that this program now is looking for a second straight 11-win season, and then Anthony Calandria has something that he can accomplish that has really been a bugaboo for UNLV football over the years.
Yeah, Calandria kind of been a revelation this year, and not to jinx it, and we talked with Mark Wallington, the sports information director, earlier this morning about some of the notable things to keep an eye out for tonight. And when Anthony Calandria takes his first snap of the game tonight, Steve, he'll be the first Rebel quarterback since John Denton in 1996 to start every single game of a season. And that alone is an accomplishment, not to mention he's the Mountain West Offensive Player of the Year. And he's one touchdown pass shy of tying our cohort on the air, Caleb Herring, who threw 25 touchdown passes back in the 2013 season. He's two behind John Denton, who had 25. That was the most in program history. So it could be a big night for Anthony Calandria. And like you said, I think the book's expecting this one to be a fast track and a high-scoring game between two teams that have been prolific on offense. The Rebels have a pretty balanced, good run game overall. Ohio mostly does it with the running. They average about 70 more yards on the ground than they do through the air per game. So it should be an interesting matchup. And, yeah, I'm interested to see what the environment is like once the game gets started here inside.
So Dan Mullen in his first year on the verge of getting 11 wins. It's interesting. I saw a content creator grading all the new coaches around college football and actually gave Mullen only a B-. I'm not saying it was an A+. It wasn't a perfect season. The goal was to beat Boise, be the king of the conference, potentially make the CFP. But those are all hard goals. So where do you have Mullen in terms of grades? And, you know, one of the things that might knock his grade down a little bit are the penalties and the mistakes. And I'll tell you tonight, penalties and mistakes could be big because if Ohio gets to play its pace and run a lot of clock, the Rebels aren't going to have a chance for, you know, a bunch of comeback opportunities.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of times earlier on in the season, they've won despite the penalties and despite themselves. We haven't seen that as much in recent weeks. There have been certain times against certain teams like Boise State where they've looked a little bit out of sorts, but you got to give credit for the turnaround, not only in terms of the discipline that plagued them early in the season, but there was that stretch of three games. It was Air Force, Boise State, and New Mexico where I think it was like 147 points allowed over those three games. They then buckled down and allowed 60 points over the next five games combined. So they really figured it out. I give them a lot of credit for the turnaround and, you know, what they were able to clean up throughout the season. I don't think you can give Dan Mullen anything short of an A-. I think that's about the lowest you could go. You could go all the way up to an A+ if you wanted, but I think A- has got to be the lowest. It's just the third time in program history that they'll have the chance to win 11 games. First time that they've gone bowling three games in a row for 3 years in a row, and I think that with what they were able to do in terms of maintaining that stability, I think you got to give credit for that as well because of what this program's been able to develop over the last couple seasons.
All right, Matt, thanks. We'll hear from Matt in about an hour and 40 minutes as part of the Ted Wiens pregame show right here on ESPN Las Vegas. You want to bet the game tonight? This part of the show is brought to you by William Hill Sportsbooks all around town, all around the state of Nevada. You download the app, you're a first-time user, you can get up to $250 in bonus bets, and then that allows you to bet anywhere on the go around the state of Nevada. Hundreds of deposit points and, of course, lots of great sports books if you need to dip into a book. But once you are downloaded with the app all set up, you can bet on your phone, on your tablet, on your iPhone. It's Cofield & Company on the road, Frisco, Texas, getting ready for the Frisco Bowl. UNLV going against Ohio. That is a 6 o'clock kickoff, almost said tip, kickoff, crossing over sports, right? As you're listening to Cofield & Company right here on ESPN Las Vegas.
Now back to Cofield & Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Cofield & Company back here, getting ready for the Frisco Bowl with UNLV and Ohio. Let's bring in our L.A. Phoenix expert. Las Vegas expert Hawaii. He's in Phoenix today as you've been traveling the West Coast. We'll get into your travels. Arash Markazi is with us. So you're in Phoenix to watch Lakers and the Suns?
The Lakers-Suns, again, this has become a bit of a rivalry now. Anytime Dylan Brooks and LeBron James are on the court together, they normally go, you know, head-to-head, neck-and-neck, quite literally. So we'll see how it goes tonight. But, yeah, this has become quite the rivalry this season.
Do you think, based on – and I would love if you spoke to an official about this because you speak to everyone, Arash, but do you think we're getting to the point with Dylan Brooks and with Dr. Dre, Draymond Green, that I feel like we're getting really close to tolerating action by these guys to the point where they're either going to freaking try to punch out a fellow player or someone's going to attack an official. I know that's a line they know they can't cross, but my God, the unbridled anger sometimes from some of the dudes.
Yeah, I mean, they know the line that they can't cross. And I think with Brooks, I mean, he's really come as close to it as he possibly can. Again, the last time that these two played each other, Brooks got ejected. He, you know, confronted LeBron. And so I think with Dylan Brooks, this goes back to when he was on the Memphis Grizzlies in the playoff series that the Grizzlies had with the Lakers. So he's not afraid of LeBron, that whole thing. Like, I want to come after the king and all that stuff. And so for Brooks, this is a big moment for him because obviously he's not in the same stratosphere as LeBron James. So, as you know, it's kind of good to have him back and forth with LeBron. But listen, they know the line that they can't cross. I mean, for example, like if he were to push or touch an official, you know, he's gone for a while. If he were to punch LeBron, he's gone for a while. And when I say a while, it's not that you're just ejected from a game and have a one game suspension. You're looking at multiple games, you know, perhaps 10-12. And again, this happened not that long ago where Draymond got a long term suspension. So again, these guys brush up against the line. Sometimes they tip over the line, but they're never gonna like blatantly cross it.
Arash is with us here from the Sporting Tribune on ESPN Las Vegas. Well, I wonder if in the proverbial negotiating room that USC and Notre Dame officials are ready to freaking cross the line and punch each other. What exactly happened here? Because I see a big blame game being played on both sides, and both sides have a lot of pride, a lot of arrogance.
Yeah, I mean, there's blame to be shared on both sides. I always think it's interesting where one blames the other. I think it's important to note that USC and Notre Dame both wanted to play this game. It's a matter of scheduling. With USC now a part of the Big Ten, going into next season, they you know, just going off of who's in the playoffs this year, next year's USC schedule includes the top two teams in the country and three of the top five teams in the country. What they basically told Notre Dame, listen, you're an important non-conference game for us. We'd love to play you during the non-conference portion of our schedule in September. Like, we don't want to be playing not only Notre Dame, we don't want to be playing non-conference games in November. Like, that's just, you know, perhaps we obviously did that back in the day when we were with the Pac-10 and the Pac-12. The college football in a variety of ways has changed. So USC proposed that to Notre Dame. They treated it like a bowl invitation and they passed. So if you want to pretend like USC is scared or didn't want to play, like that's just not true. I mean, they're probably playing the toughest schedule in the country next year. They did want to play this game. They just wanted to play it during the non-conference portion of their schedule. Again, there's no team in the SEC or the Big Ten, and I'll go to those two conferences because they're clearly the top two conferences. None of those teams are playing non-conference games in November, and they're not playing top 10 teams in November that are not part of their conference schedule. So, I do think that this game comes back in a couple of years. I do think it's important to both fan bases. I personally don't care whether it's played in September as opposed to October. I just want it to be played. So there's blame on both sides, but if you're of the mindset that USC was scared of Notre Dame, they wanted to play this game. Notre Dame just did not want to play it in September.
Yeah, it's not 5 years, 15 years, 30 years ago where they needed East Coast East Coast exposure, Midwest exposure. They have it now with the Big Ten. Here's the other thing. I've seen a bunch of people bring this up, and I think you retweeted Dan Wolkin from Yahoo in the fact that Notre Dame had this kind of secret agreement that if they're in the top 12, at the end of the rankings, at the end of the season, they will not get bumped. And you could have a scenario where USC could have a head-to-head win and then not make the playoffs because of this stupid agreement.
See, it's such a great point. And again, you only need to go to this season. If USC is the Miami of this scenario, right? Notre Dame is in the playoff instead of Miami with this new provision that says if we're in the top 12, we get in. So it what you effectively did there is say it doesn't matter who wins head-to-head. If we get to the end of the season and USC and Notre Dame are both in the top 12, and obviously you need the G5 school, but it's really important to note that this 12-team playoff is really like a 10-team playoff when you include the two G5 schools. So USC just had to look at this past season. This whole Notre Dame-Miami debate, it didn't matter. Because in beginning next season, with Notre Dame being guaranteed a spot in the playoff, and if they're in the top 12, it wouldn't have mattered if USC blew out Notre Dame 52-17. Yeah. Notre Dame is in there. So USC said, well, like, what the heck are we even playing this game for?
Arash Markazi is with us from the Sporting Tribune here on ESPN Las Vegas. So give me a feel for the NFL right now in L.A. We always ask you to kind of gauge these things, and it's not easy. It's a big city, but just the energy around NFL football, the crowds are building, and both teams appear to be headed to the playoffs with outstanding records, although they may have to both not be at SoFi in the playoffs, which kind of sucks.
No, that's the way it's going. I mean, it's going to be highly unlikely, although they both have pathways to get to the one seed and to host playoff games. It's very likely that the Rams and the Chargers will both be the number 5 seed. They both are right now at 11-4, clinched a postseason berth. Two of the top 6 teams in the league, two of the top 6 quarterbacks in the league in Matthew Stafford and Justin Herbert, two of the top 6 coaches in the league in Sean McVay and Jim Harbaugh. We are very blessed in Los Angeles to have these two great franchises. It does take time, though. So, like, you know, if, you know, very much like you see in Vegas, you know, if the Packers come to town or the Steelers or the Cowboys or whatever, like, it's still 50-50 or more of the opposing team. That comes as a byproduct of not having a pro football team here for 21 years. An entire generation of fans grew up with the opposing teams around the country. But that being said, I really like both of these teams. And I the problem is because of the pathway that they have to go for the Super Bowl. And I was in Seattle for that Rams game where they're up 30-14 with 8 minutes left in that game. If the Rams win that game, they clinch the one seed because they closed out the season against the Falcons and the Cardinals, two wins there. Now they're going to need some help. You know, they're going to need San Francisco to lose. They're going to need the Seahawks to lose. They're going to need the Bears to lose. Like, there's a lot that has to happen for them to be the one season. So while I have confidence that the Rams can go on the road and win, I think both of these teams get to the divisional round, but both of them ultimately fail to get to the Super Bowl.
What was the experience like in Seattle pregame, around the game? I saw you had tweeted out a picture of, like, $100 parking in the stadium. I knew you were there. I had another friend who was there and got images of just how loud it gets in that stadium on big plays.
It literally shakes. And again, I heard about this before the game, and I've been there for some really big games. So this was not my first time in Seattle, but the way that building and that press box in particular shook when they tied up the game and then they won the game on that walk-off touchdown in OT on that 2-point conversion. It's nothing like it. It's one of the best atmospheres in the NFL, that 12th man. It was cold. It was windy. It was kind of raining. It wasn't like a downpour, but it was a perfect Seattle night for that game to happen. So the only thing that I can say, Steve, having watched these two teams play twice this season and both of them have a win, I want to see a third matchup. And there is a scenario where if the Rams are the 5 seed and the Seahawks are the 1 seed, that maybe we get that rematch, that third game in the division round. And I would love to see it because these teams are so closely matched. Both of them came down to the last play. I would love to see them play one more time.
Going back to the Chargers and Rams, you know, deal where both are achieving at a high level, and you said, hey, it's going to take a while, and you're starting to see it with the fan base building. It is amazing how bad it is when you get it wrong. The Raiders can't get out of their own way. They've had all these coaching cycles. They've whiffed consistently. Meanwhile, the Chargers nailed it. I have no idea what happened with Jim Harbaugh and the Raiders, if there was even dialogue, but Harbaugh lands in L.A., and now they seem like a legit franchise. They've got a quarterback who's building his legend, playing with a freaking broken hand and stiff arming people with that arm, which is crazy. And then we in Vegas are watching every week 60 or 70% of the fans coming from opposing fan bases. And it we're spinning our wheels here. It's just, and I know the Chargers went through this. Listen, Staley was terrible. McCoy was terrible. They had a lot of bad head coaches, but the fact that Harbaugh is there and they're playing a bully ball style of football and winning is massive.
I just keep thinking that with the Raiders, they are like one good season away. Like I don't think it'll take as much time. Steve, you've been in Los Angeles again. Not having a team here for 21 years, I told people when the NFL comes back, you got to give it some time. With the Raiders, I think just because you have so many fans who want to, when I say want to, they want to come see a good team. So if the Raiders were 11-4 going into Sunday's game against the Giants, you're going to get fans coming in from Oakland, from Los Angeles. You're going to get Vegas fans hopping off the bandwagon. I think that turnaround from a fan point standpoint is not that far away. The problem is this has not been a quick turn for this franchise. You go back to the last time they were in the Super Bowl. They've won two playoff games. Two. Like, so this isn't like a recent occurrence. This isn't since they got to Vegas. They haven't been able to figure this thing out. They've only had two above 500 seasons since that Super Bowl season back in the day. So if they can figure it out, if they all of a sudden put together a 12-4 season, I'm telling you, the fans will come.
Check out the Sporting Tribune. Ross Marcazzi is the CEO of the Sporting Tribune. Also check out his Sporting Tribune live show that goes down Sunday to Thursdays up on the web. The Chargers have, I'm going to call him just for segue purposes here, a troubled player. I think he's just playing hard. And Denzel Perriman, who's been suspended for a couple of games for vicious plays. The Rams are starting to develop a troubled player in Puka. And I know you're around Puka post-game, and he did address some of the stuff with this Aiden Ross guy. What is going on with this dude? Not only doing these podcasts and not being aware of what this guy's setting up for, but also the comments and the officials. And I wonder where Sean McVay is right now. Like, Puka, you're a great player and you're carrying us, but dude, come on. I don't need the headaches.
This past week or 2 weeks for Puka, I'll say the past week, because not even 2 weeks. I am as shocked as I've ever been in a player, in the sense that Puka Nacua prior to this has been one of like the nicest players that I've ever covered. Like one of like the nicest, genuine human beings. Again, was not a heralded player, BYU, like low draft pick, certainly not in the top two rounds. And so I think with the live stream, he got put in a really tough spot where he was told to do things that I don't think he truly knew what they meant or the significance of that. Now, that being said, I cannot fathom how once that game is over on Thursday night, he immediately runs to his phone and tweets out something about the officials, knowing what just happened. At that point, he knew the hot water he was in. And you could tell, I've never seen Sean McVay during his time in Los Angeles that upset postgame, because I really do believe he found out from us postgame, like, wait, you guys aren't talking about the live stream. You guys are like, he literally tweeted something since we came off that field. He was irate. And I know that they've talked about it, and they had a long week coming into their game against the Falcons on Monday. I really think Puka's going to learn from this. I think he's going to close out the year strong, and this will be a blip on the radar. But Steve, again, I've never been more shocked at a player who is really one of the genuine nice guys in the league having arguably the worst week you could possibly have.
And he's got to realize he's got so much at stake, not only with his team, with the NFL, also with brand. He's representing a poly community. He's got to have a PR team around him, and they have to know who Aiden Ross is and what he does. And then the other one, I guess we heard that in weeks prior, he'd actually tried to bring these guys into the facility, and they're like, no, they're not coming into the facility. Like, bro, what are you doing? You know, kind of research who you're canoodling with.
100%. You touched on it. Like, all these big brands, again, the last game he was wearing a Toyota jacket or something. Like, all these brands are going to go away when you do dumb stuff like that. This. So I don't know who's advising him. I'm confident that the Rams have pulled him aside and said, who's giving you this advice? Who's telling you that, like, Aiden Ross's live stream is what you should be on? By the way, Steve, during a short week, like, this wasn't a normal week. This was a short week where they're flying to Seattle on Wednesday, and he's recording this on Tuesday, trying to get them into the facility. So, listen, talking to Sean McVay, he's confident that, you know, He'll sit down with them. He'll work this out. He'll learn from it. But I am really shocked at the way that Puka has really treated this whole thing. Again, the thing that I still can't get behind is the coming off the filters and going straight to your phone and tweeting something. That is absurd.
Amazing. Last couple things with Arash here on the Sporting Tribune, on ESPN Las Vegas from the Sporting Tribune. All right, I know the Lakers fans were, check that, the Knicks fans were real proud of Knicks organization that, well, they won the NBA Cup, but then they pulled this nonsense where they're like, we're not going to hang a banner. Who are the Knicks as compared to the Lakers? I know you pointed out the Lakers did the NBA a solid. The Knicks are going to be jerks about it?
That was weird, and I don't know where to land on this, because here's the thing. I agree with the Knicks that I don't think you should be hanging up. Like, if you only hang up world championship banners, which the Knicks do, which means, as you know, Steve, they haven't hung up a banner in a very long time, then you should stick with that. Like, you shouldn't be pressured into hanging a, like, cup banner. Because to be honest, like, what is a cup? You win 8 regular season games in November and December. That's what the cup is, folks. Like, you don't earn a bid into being in the cup. You're put into a pool, and you win a couple of games, and then you're in the knockout stage, and then you win a couple more games, and they give you a trophy. Like, in my mind, this is not a big deal. But the only thing that I said is, well, shoot, like, I thought this was a league mandate. So the Lakers hung one, the Bucks hung one. If the Knicks aren't going to hang one, I don't want the Lakers to have an NBA Cup banner up. That was my only thing. I got so much grief from all these Laker fans saying, well, we won it, so we should respect it. Like, I just don't think the Cup is that big a deal. Kudos to the Knicks for winning it, but I don't think it deserves a banner. That's just my 2 cents.
So less than 2 weeks out from the NBA Cup and more exposure to Adam Silver, I'm not feeling as strong about NBA expansion to Vegas as I did, say, 3 and 4 weeks ago and in years past. Are you still feeling the same deal where, well, one, you just saw and you've seen multiple times what Seattle is like. Seattle deserves a team. They had a team.
Yeah.
Their fan base is awesome. It's going to kill there. Two, he was also addressing this idea that they will expand to Europe. Is there a possibility they just look at Vegas as a, you know, an outpost, a stopping off point for big events and for the NBA Summer League? And they're like, we really don't need a team there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the feeling that I got. However, after Silver talked to the media, I do get the sense that if they do expand, and again, that's still a big if. I'm not, they're for sure going to expand. They're not going to expand to Europe. They are more focused on putting a different league in Europe. So if they do want to expand, they would expand by 2, and it would be Seattle and Las Vegas. And I do think that is a conversation that is going to be had during the All-Star break in Los Angeles. And I do think by the time we get to the Summer League next year, the 2026 Summer League, we'll get more clarity on that. And I know we wanted that clarity by now, but if the league does expand, I know that they are now being cautious of, like, not stringing along, more specifically Seattle than Vegas, because Vegas, right, they got the Summer League, they got the Cup, they got all of these events. They don't want to be in a situation where they're stringing along Seattle and Vegas for, like, years and years and years. So I think by next year, by the Summer League of 2026, we'll get some clarity if they will expand. And if they do, I think it will be to Seattle and Las Vegas.
Arash, enjoy your time in Phoenix. Enjoy the holiday. We'll check in with you next week. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks. See ya.
There he is, Arash Markazi, as we're live here in Frisco, Texas, just outside of Dallas. UNLV is going up against Ohio in the Frisco Bowl. Ted Wien's pregame show is a little over an hour away, and then kickoff live right here on ESPN Las Vegas.
It's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Hey, rolling on a Tuesday. Cofield and Company, Frisco, Texas. Adam Hill coming up in a little bit. Caleb Herring. So we'll take you right up to the Ted Wien's pregame show live here from Texas before UNLV takes on Ohio. Justin Watkins normally on Wednesdays, but we are off for Christmas Eve. So Justin, nice enough to come into the Finley Toyota Studios here to hit up some legal topics, some Christmas talk, and also a little more on the college football playoffs from a betting standpoint. Justin, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, Steve. I'm all up on your mic over here in your studio. It feels great to be in this seat.
How dare you? In the lead seat.
The lead seat.
Take over the show. No. First of all, you know, I want to go off the off our rundown that we usually trade, and I want to get your opinion on something I just saw a really strong reaction on. Just talked to Arash Markazi about USC and Notre Dame putting their series on hold for a while, and Petros Papadakis, who does LA radio and played for USC, and I'm sure his family's still a
a family that gives money to USC is all pissed off about the Notre Dame series being put on hold, and actually blames Lincoln Riley for not understanding the importance of the rivalry. And I kind of don't get what he's getting at. I think rivalries are really important, but if USC wants to win a national title, is there much of a benefit to playing Notre Dame with this secret, it's not so secret anymore, this agreement that Notre Dame got from the CFP that they're in if they're in the top 12?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that the rivalries are important anymore. You know, throw that out the window. All the rivalries are ending. They have no importance anymore, right? The important thing to consider in college football today is money. What gets you to the greatest chance of recovering and collecting money? And that means, in the football context, the CFP. It's all about the CFP. It's all about conference alignment and CFP. So if you're not doing everything you can, irrespective of tradition and rivalries and all of that, to get to the CFP, if you're a college football coach, then I think you're a dinosaur. Like that's the old way of thinking, and is not going to get you to the place that you want to be. You're not going to be at the forefront of the profession anymore.
Boy, the freaking panic around college football for funding and monies is crazy. It's like everyone's been called on their loans. I sent you a couple examples that came down in the last few days. One was Washington State. I saw a tweet saying Washington State University increased tuition by 3.3%, making it the most expensive public school in the state. Completely unrelated, this president is begging for $5 million in additional NIL cash to benefit a small percent of students. That means the athletes. And then we've talked about schools like SDSU. They just jumped their mandatory student fees for athletics from $580 to $820 a year. And San Diego State is $29 million in the hole. A lot of that's from their stadium. But, you know, trying to keep up with the Joneses. And we ask every week, like, when is this going to end? When is fiscal responsibility coming along?
Well, and you didn't even mention Dillingham, you know, signing an extension with ASU and then begging somebody to write a $20 million check, you know, basically saying, I'm happy to be here, but we're not going to be competitive unless we get some more money. And I actually got into a little bit of a back and forth with Matt Winters on Twitter about this, who I think he's awesome at covering this. But he basically said, you know, if there isn't an ROI, they wouldn't be doing it. And I completely disagree with that. I do not think there's an ROI outside of donations of alumni. Yeah. And so I think you're crazy now if you're an alumni and you're just giving this money because you have schools like University of Utah who are decoupling their revenue generating sports, and you as a donor can invest in that. So if I'm a billionaire and I'm giving tens or hundreds of millions of dollars to an institution, if I'm Phil Knight, I say, Oregon, I want to invest in this. I want a piece. And I don't think you're going to get that piece, you won't get that piece unless they decouple and they need to separate it out. And the rest of the donors are going to say, why am I giving this money? I get no return on investment. So I really don't think there's a return on investment outside the top 15, 20 schools.
Did you point out to this fellow attorney, Matt Winter, that you're actually someone who has given money to your school and you personally feel like there is no ROI, and ask him if he does that?
Oh, I personally know there's no ROI.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. But, like, did you put it on him and go, hey, bro, are you giving money to your school? Because it's an empty feeling.
Yeah. I mean, of course the schools have to continue to say, like, invest here. And, you know, they're going to rely on tradition. They're going to rely on history. They're going to rely on all that stuff. But the bottom line is that's not the sport anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, if there was some, you know, if the Oregon State wrestling program was asking for donations, yeah, I'm given to that. You know, but like football and the revenue generating, like, no, I'm out on that. It's silly. You are being duped, I think, as a donor, if you're giving money to these collectives to pay NIL money, where even if they do win, you get no ROI. And even if they do win and get to the playoff, they're all taking off anyway. They're all going to another school, and there's not a next generation of donors behind that.
Justin Watkins in the Finley Toyota studio with Cofield. I'm live here in Frisco, Texas. Frisco Bowl is on the way in about 2 hours and 20 minutes. Let's take a break here, Justin. We come back. We've got Ohio as the opponent for UNLV, and another week has gone by since that Brian Smith, the head coach, was fired, and I see more and more stuff. I don't know that Ohio did the right thing legally in this case, so we're going to have you examine this situation with the head coach being fired for an extramarital affair right here on ESPN Las Vegas.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Hour and 14 minutes from the Ted Wiens pregame show right here at the Ford Center in Frisco, Texas. UNLV taking on Ohio. I was going to bust on Justin Watkins, but he's a nice guy, so I won't do it about Oregon State in bowl games. But, Justin, you just sent me a note, and Justin's back in our studios. You just sent me a note on DK Metcalf. I always find these situations fascinating. Collectively bargained employees, can you just willy-nilly penalize them? He's going to appeal the two-game pop that he got for going after a fan. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, collective bargaining processes and the arbitration agreement really matters. A lot of deference is given to the collective bargaining. We've seen in the past, though, it is not like all-encompassing. The arbitration has to be conducted by somebody who can fairly do it. It cannot be biased against that person, nor can the arbitrator have a personal involvement in it or direct somebody to adhere to it or arbitrate the matter. But here, I think it's a funny situation to litigate out. I think you know, if you grabbed a jury, I think you get half the people think, hey, if a racial slur was uttered, then completely justified. Like, you know what? The guy deserves to get punched, and there should be no punishment. And I think that there's a significant portion of people, too, that would say, like, this isn't your first run-in with this dude. Why'd you go over there? And I tend to be on the latter camp of you knew this dude wasn't going to say something nice to you. You had a previous run-in. He's in his chair. You're way away from it, and you work your way all the way over there to have an interaction, to just and to, you know, arguably assault him, which is only going to empower him. Now you've invited him into your life permanently, because this dude's definitely going to sue you. And so, you know, all around a really dumb move. And from the NFL standpoint, you just can't have it. There has to be a zero tolerance of you going to the fans to find trouble, regardless of what the fans are saying. I've got a little bit of sympathy for NBA players because those fans are right on top of you. But DK Metcalf here had to walk 15, 20 feet over to this dude to interact. And I don't think there's any real chance that the two-game suspension gets reduced. And he's definitely going to get sued civilly, no doubt about it.
Oh, wow. Justin Watkins with us here on Cofield & Company, ESPN Las Vegas, live in Vegas and live here in Dallas. Okay, the latest that's come out with some of the language and more of the details on this Bryan Smith dude, the former head coach at Ohio, and UNLV's playing Ohio coming up here in a little bit. He was fired last week. The school mentioned extramarital affairs, drinking. Also put in there that he was dating an undergrad student. We found out the undergrad student was actually 41 years old. That kind of gives it a different feel to me. There was also comments about he was bringing women or that woman back to a hotel on campus. It turns out I think that's where he was living after he separated from his wife. What do you see here in terms of his rights and what the school did?
I see very little in the term of his rights. You know, they have very strict rules, like do not date students. I'm assuming that that's in his contract. And
she's
in
41.
Doesn't matter. Age doesn't matter.
Fair game.
Right? Age does not matter. You can't make, well, you know, then where do you draw the line, right? You make a very clear rule that people can understand and follow easily, and that is you don't date a student. Right? That's simple. Otherwise, what are you going to put in there? A formula? Your age divided by 2 plus 7, right? That's the number. That's as low as you can go, and then it's okay, you know? But then below that, you're creepy, and so then it's against the rules. You can't do that. You got to look at it from the employer standpoint of, like, we are putting these grown men and women in these coaching positions, in these elevated positions for the university. They are, in a lot of ways, the face of the university. And so, like, not only morality, but they have a higher standard, really, than everybody else. But really, the standard that they're asking of him is no different than any other professor or teacher or staff member at that university. I guarantee they don't tolerate dating a student by any of those positions.
Right.
And so if you're going to run your university, you have to fire him. You have to fire him. And then, you know, otherwise, anytime anybody does that in all of your staffing, they're just going to point to you over here and say, look, you didn't fire him. You can't fire me. So you've got to be hardline on this stuff. Age doesn't matter. Whether or not he's separated or divorced or still together, none of that matters. The hardline rule is don't touch a student.
Are you done? There's no segue for that. Are you done with all of your Christmas shopping, especially for your kids?
Done with the kids, yeah. I think I'm going to head out tomorrow. I like to go.
I
love going on Christmas Eve. I really do. I like going and just wandering the mall and seeing what I stumble upon. And I always find, the little things that nobody's asked for, but I thought was a good idea.
Look at you.
I find those on Christmas Eve. You know, I would love to do it today. Today's a very special day, but we got the VGK game, got some dinner, so I don't have time to do all that stuff. But it doesn't mean that I don't have a bone to pick with you, Steve.
Are you going to go Festivus without officially being a Festivus show? Okay, what's the bone? Let's do it. Let's do it. You're the only one who gets to air the grievance.
No, I'm not going to air the grievance. I can't take it away. I can't take it away from everybody else. But if I were to have a Festivus grievance, it would be about your fantasy football play and your drafting, about how you go in. You come in and say, well, I'm just, I don't know what's going on. I'm just here to destroy everybody else's team. That's all BS. Yes. You want to win too, but you can always point back to, no, I was just bidding that up and I got stuck with them. So I don't like my team. I don't like where I ended up, but it's fine because I don't really care about winning. I just care about you losing and me taking your people and bidding you up too high. So I'm not buying it. You want to win. You didn't this year. I'm not going to, I'm in the Super Bowl.
Now you're great. Your team's great. I know. Excuse.
But, I don't want to, every time I talk about it, I fall flat on my face. It'll be a good matchup against Jake, and it'll be a fun one.
We talked about favorite Christmas songs. Adam Hill is going to be coming on in a little bit, but he's not allowed to come on and talk about the holidays because he doesn't like them. So we go with an Adam Hill-free zone during Christmas talk. Favorite Christmas songs, you're becoming an old man. Are your tastes changing? I'm a much older man than you.
Yeah. I mean, I've always really liked the older Christmas songs. I just drove to California for a volleyball tournament with my daughter last weekend, and I had it on the Christmas station, and it was all the old stuff, right? And, I'm sitting there singing along, and she's like, dude, how do you know all these songs?
It gets ingrained, man. It's crazy.
Yeah. And I'm like, I just love them. As soon the day after Thanksgiving, I'm always listening to Christmas music in the car. Big fan of Christmas music. So,
nice.
You've teased me for, a better part of 5 years now about me saying the top Christmas song was All I Want for Christmas Is You.
Well, I put you on the spot and you just blurted out Mariah Carey and I'm like, that's your song now.
Yeah.
Now you're like, I demand a change.
Yeah, I need
There's
to have my
recount.
Day.
Yeah.
I need to have my day. I think the best Christmas song, there's a couple in the top, there's a top three kind of for me, but the Christmas song, Nat King Cole, Chestnuts Roasting on Open Fire, that's the song.
Nice.
And this wonderful time of the year is right there, too. And then I'll give an honorable mention to the one my daughter said is, her favorite when she hears it. She's 13. When she hears it, she knows it's Christmas. And I was like, okay. And it's I Saw Santa Kissing or Mama Kissing Santa Claus.
By who, though? Does she know the best one?
No, she definitely doesn't. That's done by quite a few artists, right? Who's the original?
I think, I don't know who did the original. I think the best is Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5.
I don't like that version, but
really?
Okay. Yeah. I don't love the song, but she just remembers. She remembers when she believed. She remembers, when she was much younger, she was like, this song's messed up, dude. And then as she gets older, she's like, wait a minute, why would I don't understand the song? And I'm like, well, so and so is so and so. And she's like, oh, okay, I'm an idiot. Okay, I love this song now, And so, and she's come full circle with it.
So my favorite singers going way back for older songs, and two of them are much older. Well, I guess whatever. Burl Ives is awesome. Andy Williams.
My
favorite song is still and probably forever will be This Christmas by Donny Hathaway.
Wow.
But there are – that's a great song. You gotta look it up. There are newer artists, and I'm not saying they're, like, young, but there are newer artists who have actually done really good versions of songs. I actually think Bieber's Christmas album, he might have a second, is really good. Carly Rae Jepsen, who did that song, maybe, she has a good Christmas song. But can I tell you, my second favorite Christmas song is from The Year Without a Santa Claus, where Santa gets – he's sick, right? And they're like, oh, man, Santa's not going to be here. He's also – he's kind of upset because the Christmas spirit is dying down, just like an elf. Ed Asner, I could do this forever, by the way. Ed Asner is like the Santa spirit meter's way down. The song "I Believe" that Mickey Rooney does, awesome.
Okay.
Yep. Watch The Year Without a Santa Claus. Most people know that as the Heat Miser, Cold Miser.
Okay.
That's what it's known for. You watch that. The "I Believe" kind of early on is great.
I'm gonna go.
And I will say. Cool. I know what you did with your kids, and I know what you were going to blurt out. That's why I love that song. I think of what you told your kids, and all you honest parents, like Miracle on 34th Street, when the mom tells the daughter very early, like 7 years old, "There's no Santa. That's just silly. There's a Santa."
No. I didn't tell.
You're
my kid. I just didn't lie to him. I deflected for a little bit, but I never lied. And I'm going to throw in honorable mention Gene Autry.
Rudolph.
No. I'm actually going with Frosty because the song came before any of the story. The song generated a whole movie because they tell a whole story in the song. So I'm going to give Gene Autry, Frosty the Snowman, a hat tip there. I love that song. I love that it's the original. And like you said, Andy Williams Christmas albums, like right there. Bing Crosby, standard. Obviously, right there. And then more current, I'm going to say, obviously, Mariah Carey. That's not super current. Bieber's is pretty good. I have to give you that one.
That's good. That's
I have to give you that
next
one.
Next year, we're gonna cross-check this with the daughter. So, Justin, I appreciate you coming in. Have a good holiday. Tell your family Merry Christmas, and we'll talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, Merry Christmas. Happy Festivus.